Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yeah, Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast where we review audiobooks, then come back and give them a very deep discussion. So this week we're discussing Library at Mount Char by Scott Hawkins, 2015. Narrated by Hilary Huber. Barry, could you give us a reading of the back of the book, please?
It's a hell of a back of the book.
It is.
We're getting
a lot of really long backs of the books.
Yeah, if you want to be as confused as I was when I first read this book, you should not listen to this back of the book, because then you'll be totally confused. This will give you some context.
It is not guaranteed that you will be as confused as Kevin if you read the back of this book, but you will be confused. Barry, would you please start reading at any time now?
How about now? A missing god, a library with the secrets to the universe, a woman too busy to notice her heart slipping away. Carolyn's not so different from the other people around her. She likes guacamole and cigarettes and steak. She knows how to use a phone. Clothes are a bit tricky, but everyone says nice things about her outfit with Christmas sweater over the gold bicycle shorts. After all, she was a normal American herself once. That was a long time ago, of course, before her parents died, before she and the others were taken in by the man they call father. In the years since then, Carolyn hasn't had a chance to get out much. Instead, she and her adopted siblings have been raised according to father's ancient customs. They've studied the books in his library and learned some of the secrets of his power, and sometimes they've wondered if their cruel tutor might secretly be God. Now, father is missing, perhaps even dead, and the library that holds his secrets stands unguarded, and with it, control over all of creation. As Carolyn gathers the tools she needs for the battle to come, fierce competitors for this prize align against her, all of them with powers that far exceed her own. But Carolyn has accounted for this, and Carolyn has a plan. The only trouble is that in the war to make a new god, she's forgotten to protect the things that make her human.
Alrighty.
That was a hell of a ride.
Yep.
Yeehaw.
Well, we got through that in almost, anyway.
18 takes.
So, what did everybody think? Kevin, let's start with you.
Okay. This is kind of a two-part review. One, I like the book. I really like the book. But the first time I read the book, it was incredibly painful, and I really didn't like the first about two-thirds. Whenever you listen to the book, the first two-thirds was fine. So it was kind of a case of context, where you don't get the context till like after two-thirds of the way through the book. And there was kind of this blunt, casual brutality that kind of happens throughout the book with people getting like tortured and maimed. And it's not like that descriptive, you know, it's like mentioned, it's not like full paragraphs of people being tortured, but you know, when they mention, you know, licking tears off of severed heads and stuff like that. And I just wasn't in the mind space to listen to that. And I was just like, God, what is up with this book? It's like so messed up.
Some days you don't like to hear about licking tears off of severed heads. Because
in the right context, it could be hilarious, dark comedy, right?
Sure.
But it's a strange day that I don't enjoy that.
So it was like, and it's weird because now, like I said, I listened to it again and it was just like, you know, that part, I'm like, in context, it was fine. But just, I just wasn't in the headspace to deal with that at first. And it was just kind of like, it also made me miss about half a dozen clues as to where they explicitly say clues as to what's going on. And I just didn't hear them at all. Like the second re-listen, I'm like, I don't remember hearing that line. So I think you have to be willing to stick it out through the whole thing if you're going to start it.
Fair enough. I enjoyed this book. I didn't have quite so much trouble with it as you two. Once again, because I was, you know, sort of in the back, sort of trying to catch up. And so I had already heard that this was essentially completely incomprehensible. And so I was expecting to have to learn a new alphabet or something. And so I was pleasantly surprised when it was just about a group of very strange people. And
so we have something akin with them?
Yes. Yeah. And of course, like us, they have mysterious powers and could destroy the world.
Oops.
This is a book where if you are particularly sensitive to descriptions of abuse or, well, descriptions of anything bad, I mean,
there is a lot of casual violence in this book.
There's a pretty much any kind of unpleasantness that you can name. I mean, it's in there.
Right. You know, father, their, you know, their father figure who adopted them, just like, hey, you know, and he taught them in the old ways, you know, right. They said, you know, by the time they were eight, they all had scars and stuff like that. And that was like in the first 20 minutes of the book, and I'm just like going, God, what? I don't know if I want to listen to this.
Sometimes we joke around that this is the darkest timeline, and I'm thinking maybe this book is maybe a better example of some ways the darkest timeline could be.
You mean an improvement?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I thought kind of after the fact is it kind of got to an oddly good description of what it would be like to be a Greek god.
Sure.
Like, you're like, oh, that kind of explains why they do these crazy things. They have these amazing powers, but they don't quite get why people, you know, want food every day and like wear clothes. Cause you know, just stuff like that, that is not a preconception I have, but at the end, I'm like, oh, wow. Now I understand the Greek gods really well.
Now, I was a bit feverish over the weekend, and I often will pick some particular concept or thing that, you know, my feverish brain latches onto. And for some reason, I started thinking about the parallels between this and the demigod Maui, played by The Rock. Well, sorry, Dwayne Johnson. Got to be careful these days in Moana. And he's basically the comic version of the father in this.
Right.
He's created everything. He's not exactly a god. He just sort of
had a demigod.
He's a demigod. You know, he doesn't have necessarily the power to just sort of say, oh, now this is happening. No, he has to use some tome or use some tool or magical object. Maui would be like the far off most positive version of this. And even Maui can be a little bit dark. Whereas, this is a book. It's sort of Neil Gaiman-y in some ways. But I think that there's actually a little bit more moral ambiguity going on even than often goes on in Neil Gaiman. Because in Neil Gaiman, you can sort of tell the good guys from the bad guys most of the time. And in this case, it was really hard to tell a lot of the time.
Especially without the context of the back of the book. I had no idea what was happening or what was going to happen. So it was just sort of like, huh? And then you see stuff going on and you're like, yeah, like you said, you know, you could see who's winning, but you couldn't quite tell who was good and bad. And, you know, there were a couple Americans that, you know, were part of the thing. And
now, there's a book that I read called Stone Junction that was about somebody who is similarly trained up to be this sort of super assassin type of person and wound up with kind of magical powers. And I was trying to figure out, it seems like there is a much closer parallel to this, but I can't actually figure it out. So it's sort of Stephen's last, you know, literary theorem. It's just like, there is a near perfect review of this book, but if I were to say it in this podcast, it would go on indefinitely.
Exactly. You can asymptotically approach it.
So I really enjoyed this book.
Good.
I do have to admit to being a bit confused for about the first third. There's a lot of things that happen in that part of the book that don't seem all that connected, and you're still trying to like get your sea legs, so to speak, I think. And in hindsight, you know, and also on the second listen, they seem to make a lot more sense, but it didn't detract from the enjoyment of the book for me. And like you guys are saying, there is a lot of casual violence, and a lot of the graphic violence is often very short and punctuated. So,
right. Like I said, it's not like a whole paragraph of someone being tortured. It's just a very graphic image that you're like, wow, okay, I wasn't really expecting that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there are some very vivid, short descriptions of things that can definitely like take you out of like one headspace and put you in another pretty quick. If you're sensitive to that, you might want to skip that.
Yeah, the one thing I always wonder about books is you're like, okay, you know, sometimes I treat them like a Voight-Kampff test, where, you know, where it's like I may or may not like the book, but at least I get emotional response from it. And so it's like I give the author credit if I actually care enough to hate something.
Hurt me so I can be proven to feel.
Yes, exactly.
Show me I'm human.
And so it wasn't quite like that, but it was because it was just at first I just, you know, hadn't sort of connected enough. But I guess my question is that the intention? You know, are you supposed to have this reversal once you get context after you hit half, two thirds of the way through the book and you go, oh, the people that I was thinking were kind of reprehensible and whatever, it's like now I understand where they're coming from and it kind of makes more sense. And now it seems like they're kind of a good guy in a way.
And they're kind of like some deep anti-heroes in some ways.
But it's like, I guess my question is, you know, if the book were constructed in a different manner, you would have the context from the beginning. So was the point of the book, not the point of the book, but the point of the structure that you have this reversal partway through, you know, or would it be the same if you had the context from the beginning, and then you kind of would see where it was going the whole time.
I think that, yeah, the point of the book has to be, because it's happening also on all kinds of levels all the way through the book. And that we can get into in the discussion section. But sometimes, for example, Caroline will do something and we'll sort of think, oh, she's a monster. And then we'll see a little bit wider context and think, well, maybe she's not. Then we might see even a bit wider context, maybe start thinking she is again.
Yeah, or just like, she just seems like doesn't get it.
And I mean, these are essentially demigods operating in a different moral framework.
Right. I mean, at one point, the character basically says, you know, you're operating on a totally different level, aren't you? and it definitely seems to be.
Well, and even then, way. You know, the person that was said to didn't even seem to really acknowledge.
Right. I don't know what you mean.
Statement.
Exactly. So what did we think of the narrator?
I actually really enjoyed listening to this book. I thought that Hillary did a fantastic job sort of disambiguating all the different characters. And there are a lot of different characters in this book.
Right. You definitely got a feeling for their personality just through her readings of them.
Yeah. The voice inflections, I thought, were, at least for me, I really enjoyed them.
There were quite a few fictional languages that she had to get through, not to mention animal noises that she had to make rather convincingly. So, yeah, very good job on her part. So, yeah, I think we're walking a little bit too close to the spoilers and our ears are starting to bleed. So let's move on to our discussion section where we can uncap the hidden secrets of the library at Mount Char. All right, and welcome back to our discussion section for Library at Mount Char. So yeah, we always, for fantasy or near fantasy books, or whatever this may be called, we tend to like to talk about the magic system. This didn't have a classic magic system. This was sort of based on knowledge, the idea that there were just all of these things you could learn about the world.
Yeah, I couldn't decide whether to put this into magic or to put it into science or somewhere.
Sure.
You know, a foot in each side. I don't know.
Right.
Well, in the book itself, you know, Caroline very clearly says there is no magic, Steve, or whatever. Like,
quite possibly, literally.
Yeah, she's basically like, you know, this is all just stuff. You know, she's like, anybody could learn this stuff. You know.
So, did everybody else hear their own name and the sort of side character, or was it just me?
That's part of the magic of the book.
Yeah, exactly. There's no magic, Barry.
Yes.
Excuse me. That's part of the science of the book.
I see. Are you the new son?
It's the personalized audio book release for every person on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought this was a kind of a interesting, whatever we want to call it, system.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have this giant library of almost all knowledge, or not almost all, but a huge amount, and... And yeah, he kind of, what, there were 12 catalogs, right?
Right.
Plus the Black Folio, whatever that was. Like,
well, they also had a description of the catalog system that they used to describe where books were in the library, which was, what, something like the size of like 12 football fields or something.
It was a giant pyramid, I think.
It was, you know, what floor do you need to be on? What radial? Which case? Which shelf? And which slot? You know, and it's a lot bigger than, I guess, standard library catalog systems.
Uh-huh.
Right. So the thing that the first time that I missed was that Carolyn was the one doing everything right. Now, they say on the back of the book that basically she's the one doing everything, but I hadn't read that. And then
I actually hadn't either. So,
and then they mentioned about half a dozen times that, oh, like when she went into the RESAC to get Michael, she was like, she faked that she was being injured by going into it. And they mentioned like half a dozen times her faking. She thought it looked, you know, she looked fine, or that they wouldn't notice she was faking. I didn't notice any of those somehow. It's like, and so like, it wasn't until the very, very end where she's actually fighting David that I'm like, oh, and he says, oh, you killed father. And she said, yeah, it was me. I'm like, oh, it was her. That was like the first time I actually like noticed it. And like somehow I was just like, I don't know what happened.
Well, even her father was, you know, when she resurrects him, right?
Right.
And she's having this conversation with him and he says, well, I always kind of figured it would be you. I just figured it was like 50 or 100 years down the line or something. Right.
He's like, good job.
Yeah, he's like kind of, you know, he's kind of proud of her. He's like, yeah.
Oh, well,
way to go. I mean,
this was his plan.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, she thought that she was rebelling against him and she was as part of his plan to retire, essentially.
Right.
Yeah. It's a hell of a retirement plan.
Yeah. Let me go start at my own universe. And
right. Because he's sort of isn't fully a god before then, but now he's going to sort of try being a complete god by actually creating a universe.
It's called delegation.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, like, they go back to the, you know, the prehistory where it's, you know, what is it, the emperor that was running everything, and he sort of rebels against the emperor. And
right.
But yeah, so it's going through, like we were saying, this, you know, so I was like confused, except for the fact that David is a complete psychotic asshole that has his like blood helmet and like, which sounds like a great, you know,
yeah,
name of some kind.
Well, it might deflect a 22, but anything bigger.
It was just, you know, that's kind of like the, okay, I could see a Greek god doing something weird like that. You know, it's like,
yeah, absolutely. There's, I mean, in some ways it's a, it's a more direct take on what these different kinds of gods would actually be like.
Right.
I mean,
well, cause yeah. It made sense when it's like, okay, there's the goddess of death. Cause that's just, she's studying,
right.
You know, there's that disturbing section where she has these, kind of automatons or whatever, or helpers. And it's like, how do you make them? Well, you know, wasn't it something like she had to kill the child herself?
Right.
And then like were do they, something to them. And
they
like,
were her own children, I think, or
I didn't think they were her own. I thought right. She just, you know, and so it was like, you know,
she strangled babies.
Yeah. And you're just like kind of going, what is up with this? And then like, I mean, at the end, it's like, not like that makes that okay. Right. But somehow in context, isn't so
relative to the other atrocities. It's okay.
Well, I mean,
none
of it's okay, but it's like somehow in it's sort of like you can have a dark comedy that you can deal with because you know it's a comedy in a way.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not a realistic novel. It's right. Not trying to be a realistic novel. It's not even that realistic necessarily about the normal humans.
Right. And I did love how they basically referred to all humans as Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think they ever once used the term humans. They just said, oh, you know, I used Americans to do this. And like,
right. And so, which was sort of interesting in that this was a very global ending. I mean, you know,
well, yeah.
Were they referring to all humans as Americans, even when they weren't actually American?
So I think that while in a lot of the book, everything was sort of centered in the United States, I think that it's sort of like this, you know, misconception of like first contact with Earth. Mm-hmm. The United States sent out a probe. So, you know, they, you know, like, hi, we're Americans. And, you know, like yeah. They're the space aliens that showed up and they're like, okay, you're all Americans. And then right. It turns out that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. What is it? There's like the Amish used to have a term as like referred to us as the English or something like that.
Those other people.
I forget what that was.
Well, and so the other thing was there were sort of like hints of Lovecraftian type things that were in here were like even there was a section where I guess what Margaret who was, you know, exploring you know, where you went before and after, you know, before you were born, after you were died.
There was also the slight Lovecraftian hint of the people with tentacles coming up.
Well, right. They were talking about sort of father's enemies, and there was one that would, you know, turn people's fingers into tentacles that would make them more susceptible to her like suggestible influence.
Right.
And it was sort of like this mind virus. So she's like, just don't touch them. It's fine. You know,
one of my favorite characters was this cab driver that they called to rescue this one guy. I'm just imagining his day where he starts out and it's just an ordinary day. His one driver is out. And right. So he agrees to go and pick somebody up, and there's thousands of dogs that suddenly attack him, and then he goes in to rescue them, and then there are lions. After that whole experience, he is just sort of trying to limp home or something. No, he gets rescued.
The housekeeper bites his finger off.
Right. The housekeeper bites his finger off. Then Carolyn shows up later, interacts with him later.
She's looking for Steve, and he's like, you know, that fucker that stole my stuff or whatever. And
she's like, here's a bag of cash.
Yeah. He's like, what am I going to do without my van? She's like, here's, you know, he'll like
300 grand or something.
Or, yeah. So, right. And she's like, go off, you know, maybe a high building, buy a bunch of food and guns and like, you know, keep your family up there and don't touch anybody that's tentacles. And
yeah. If there are people with tentacles, don't touch them. I can't think of a stranger set of things that somebody could tell me to do.
It sounds like Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's just sort of like...
Most of that seems like a good idea, generally.
Yes.
I mean, the interesting part is that whole scene there is, what is it, prefaced by the fact that Steve is giving a lion a suppository twice.
Yeah.
And survives.
And actually, you know, Steve and the lion turns out to be like one of the best
buddy relationships.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, so, yeah, then there were some, like, you know, they talked about other fathers, other enemies, like Q-33 North, which was apparently some, I think it was a pyramid shape, like piece of an iceberg or something like that, or just it hid in an iceberg or something like that. And like, and just, there were a lot of other weird,
they put a like lot that. Of background texture in.
Right.
And,
right.
And they didn't bother to explain, or I guess, you know, Scott Hawkins didn't bother to explain a lot of it.
Right.
I mean, it was like this sort of casual reference to this guy named Barry O'Shea.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who's Barry O'Shea? Like, and why does he have my name?
You know, Nobunaga comes along.
Was there
along.
A Kevin? Are you feeling left out?
Yeah, I think I was left out.
Oh, man. As we said, this is somewhat what it would be like to actually be a god or a demigod or a quasi-god.
And it's kind of also kind of a game garage look at being a god, right?
It
almost seems a little, not silly, but more absurd.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because they talk about, like, you know, the resurrection, right? And, you know, was this the after the big one, the bull one or something? And she like, and you know, so she's getting the things that she needs to resurrect him. And it's like one of them is like a spool of like magnetic tape or something like that. And she chews it up and spits it into his eyes and just random stuff like that. And you're like, okay, this does very much feel like, you know, okay, what material components do you need for your spell?
Right. And even then it's still a two-part process, which is, I thought was an interesting take on the resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first part is essentially repairing the body.
Sure.
And then the second half is, you know, bringing, you know, if you want to call it a soul back, you know, into the physical body.
Right. I mean, there was a lot of interesting folk magic stuff going on. I mean, you know, there were all kinds of different magical systems sort of coexisting. It wasn't sort of, you know, often in fantasy novels, there is sort of like one sort of specified, oh, you have your energy reservoir and this and this. And
right.
This was just like thousands of different disciplines. They'd all learned different things.
Right. They had the 12 catalogs, right? And so Father was very specific about don't cross the streams, basically. He's like, right. You know, if you learn something else from another catalog, you know, that's not tolerated. And so that's like, you know, kind of one of the defining things in all of their, you know, shared experience was that, you know, when that happens, you know, David, who is sort of like the war god or whatever, and he's helping out, was it Margaret, I guess? Father would just randomly murder her. Right.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that seems like it's true for most of his children,
but she was the death goddess. So like, you know, I guess he was giving her experience or something.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he was sending her to the land of the dead.
Right. And he would do it randomly or with her knowledge in all these different ways. And, you know, right. That's part of another thing you're going like, God, what is with this book?
Well, there was also a lot of psychological terror in that particular interaction. Right. He said like, oh, I'm going to like, he puts like the knife on the table and he says, I'm going to kill you, and then wait several weeks to do it.
Yeah.
You know,
and I mean, so I got on Goodreads at one point and I noticed that an acquaintance of mine had called out the book, and I think correctly, for showing abuse and then showing it being justified at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I did it to make you a better person.
Yeah. And I think that that's a fair criticism. I think that that one lands. I don't think that it makes it impossible to enjoy the book, but I think that that is definitely something that, you know, you should think about as a moral. But yeah, that is definitely what's going on in the book, is that Father is trying to create this, you know, and like we said, Father is this demigod that is trying to create his successor. And so he needs obviously that person to be an independent person. So
it's literally like a shark tank.
Right. You know, it's like a laser or something where you're bouncing stuff back and forth between two mirrors or something like that. And actually he's tried this a bunch of different times and gone back and changed the past. And at the end, it's revealed that Father had specifically wound up choosing Caroline and was intending for her to strike back.
Right. I mean, that was the point. In fact, one of my favorite parts is that reveal where, she's asking him these questions after she resurrects him, when she, you know, he basically left a note for her saying like, hey, good job, you know, you killed me and now you're the new god.
It's like the Easter egg.
Yeah, basically. And so she resurrects him to kind of ask him about stuff. And
I mean, it would have been great if it was just like, ha, you fell for my trap.
Yeah. So they were talking about, you know, she asked him, well, why did you, you know, smile when you put Steve in the bowl, or not Steve, when you put David in the bowl? And he was like, you know, he was like, please, you know, don't do this or whatever. He was screaming, I guess. And like, and so that was like, you know, the big kind of, you know, thing that happened was, you know, to make sure nobody showed their catalogs, you know, he punishes David for doing it and he puts him in the bowl and burns him for like 3 days in this, you know, giant cooker shaped like a bowl.
Yeah, basically smokes him to death.
Right. And so it's like, and you know, he's screaming, you know, he has the technique to kind of not feel pain, but of course, eventually at the end, he's like this like burned out husk and then they have to resurrect him again.
Right.
So, you know, and he's sitting there screaming and that's like, you know, they have nightmares about that forever. And, you know, and it's basically like, okay, now we are sure we're not going to share catalogs and stuff. And, you know, he says to her like, well, I know you are the one basically because you would never complain. And she's like, well, maybe I would if you put me in the bowl. And he's like, oh no, you never did. Yeah. And then she's like, huh? And yeah. He's like, 9 times I tried to get David to be the one, but you always beat him. And he's like, you were terrifying. You were like a million times worse than David ever was. You were like the worst thing ever created, basically.
Yeah. He says like something along the lines of, you know, you just stared back at me with like hate in your eyes.
Right. And he basically says, one time I burned you twice so that you knew what was coming. And the second time you just looked at me and I still have nightmares about that look. And you're like, wow, you know, if David, you know, was portrayed as being really horrible and she's that much worse. And it's like, well, okay, I guess it's good that she's not the evil god at this point or whatever. Or she's some god anyway, but.
Yep.
Well, I mean, I think also leading up to that particular scene, you know, where she resurrects father, you know, what kind of drives her to that is Steve sort of committing suicide repeatedly, you know, and she keeps bringing him back and she doesn't understand why he keeps doing it.
Which, well, right.
Because she's saying, look, I'm God now. Yeah. I can give you literally anything.
Yeah.
Right.
He's like, oh, that's nice.
And he's, well, because he's concerned about the people on Earth, right?
Right.
And that
right.
Basically it turns out that the sun is like some magically, you know, inflamed like creature that was one of Father's buddies.
Right. And so she'd killed it.
And right. She basically was like, I can't take any chances. So she takes the sun down, you know, kills the person that it was. And that's another kind of weird example of the magic system where, so she has such hatred for David that in the moment of his death, she like
stops time.
Yeah. She stops time and she puts him in this like freeze time bubble.
Right.
And so she's like, and he's connected to the plane of agony or the plane of despair or whatever. And so time will literally never move forward for him. So he's now experiencing despair for eternity. And she was like really happy about it. Yeah. And so you're like, that's when you're like, is she a good person? I don't know, but.
A while, she's even like kind of toting around with like a shoelace tied to his toe, like in a floating, you know, anti-grav bubble or something.
So she tries to turn him into the sun.
Well, she does turn him into the sun, except it's because he's connected to so much agony and despair.
Right.
He's like this black, you know,
non-reading. Black sun.
You can get our Soundgarden reference in, that rare one.
Yes.
But she's like, well, he still radiates heat. And, you know,
yeah, that's
and
enough, really.
And Steve's like, well, what about all the plants? You know, like nothing's growing anymore. People are rioting.
I know. And she's just like,
well, there's mushrooms and stuff people can eat. They'll learn.
Yeah. She's got, I know a trick for that. Whatever. I'll get to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is she's so disconnected from like day to day. It's like, she doesn't quite get why that would bother people. She's like, they'll just, what are they complaining about? They're not going to freeze to death. It just, there's not much light, whatever. You know, and he's like very patiently trying to be like, but you know, this stuff is happening, right? There used to be like riots once every 10 years. Now there's like several every day, like everywhere.
It's like, is that bad?
Right. So that's kind of what I was saying, where it kind of makes you think like, okay, that's maybe how a Greek god would act, or they're just like not quite cognizant of what's going on. Did you notice
that the bottle of Everclear was $7,000 at the grocery store? She's like, nope, But I did notice they didn't have very much guacamole.
Right. At Monsieur Taco or whatever that place was. And like Steve was like kind of going, huh? That's such like, you know, like that name just doesn't make sense. Like
the French taco place. Yeah.
And it's like a weird upscale, like, you know, maitre d' and everything.
I mean, what is it? Steve ends up committing suicide several times, I think. Once,
oh yeah,
the first time he immolates himself with Everclear,
with the help of the lion to keep her at bay,
yeah,
right, while he does it. Because, and that's the interesting thing is, you know, so there's something that because we listen on audio, we weren't quite sure whether the term heart coal, COAL, was actually what it was called, which it turned out it was. But
yeah,
I took me a while to kind of parse that phrase that was used a few times. And it was like, you know, kind of what keeps you going when in the bad times, you kind of like have some memory that you can like nurse off of. And so like Steve was her heart coal. And so after all this, you know, that's why she picks him, right?
Right.
Is like, she's like, okay, this is this person that I remember as a kid. We were kind of friends or whatever. I don't remember if
she had a crush on him.
Yeah. Or something like that.
And he was originally going to be one of Father's chosen ones, right? And
well, he was there.
But
Father purposely sent him away.
Right.
Because, you know, he said, oh, all the catalogs are done, but obviously he could do whatever he wanted. He basically said at the time that you don't find out till the end that you will be her heart coal.
Right.
You know.
Well, Steve's the one that kind of helps her survive the nuclear blast, right? Because the bomb has gone off and all the kids are running up to the top of the hill. And the leading edge of the blast wave is encroaching, but he's cast that spell that allows them to move faster, but they can't move too fast because then
the friction
with the air starts to ignite their clothing and, you know, hair and stuff like that. And, you know, at some point Carolyn stumbles,
right?
And Steve kind of turns around and, you know, gets her to get back up and keep moving, right? Mm-hmm. And all the other kids were just, you know, going as fast as they can to get to Adam Black and the safety of the barbecue at the top of the hill. I don't know, but
yep. Which leads us weirdly enough to our usual questions. So was there tea? Apparently tea was mentioned. Carolyn liked it.
Yeah. I don't remember them drinking it, but she said, oh, well, I like it and stuff or something like that.
So we have an endorsement of tea from the new God of the universe. Yeah. Yes.
There's a lot of other things she liked too.
That's true. She didn't actually kill anybody with it, as far as I recall. What character would you want to be, and or who would you be? I'm going to make a very weird case for Steve, because at the end, he is frozen in a moment of perfect bliss for the rest of eternity, far as I understand.
And he becomes the new son.
He becomes the new son, so he's being completely useful and just like also like completely happy at all at the same time.
He is sort of the Jesus figure. Not sure what else you can like
ask for.
Does he come out like the most ahead in this book?
I think so. I mean it kind of depends.
What about Erwin?
Which one's he?
He's the military guy that
yes,
ends up in jail. And
there was an interesting moment with Erwin, which may be a little bit political, but you know, he meets with the president, and it's the kind of book where, you know, he's so macho that he's out machoing everybody else in the room.
Well, yeah, he stares down one of the other prison guards at one point, despite him being, you know, 6 inches taller or something.
Exactly.
And he's like, you're going to do what I tell you.
And let's see. So, yeah, Erwin, you know, winds up sort of becoming the president's poker buddy briefly, or at least, you know, potential poker buddy. And I had this sort of like, oh, how sweet. It's a good president.
You know, I think you had asked me, I think last week or maybe even a little bit earlier, about who I thought the president was supposed to be.
Right. Or was this supposed to be now? Or
And so I thought about that for a while on the second listen. And I actually think it's sort of like a proto Nixon. A little bit, right? He's kind of, you know, like a little, you know, shifty and, you know.
It makes sense.
Well, I did actually find funny that early on, so there's the first attack, you know, when on adoption day, as they call it, you know, when the bomb goes off and the kids get adopted. And, you know, and then Father's like, I'm going to have to punish the president for doing this. And she's like, oh, he's not gonna be president anymore. He's like, that, and he'll never have been president.
Yeah. And that's obviously in its history.
She's like, what, the, you know, it's complicated, but you know, the past kneels before me. And
right.
And then he's like, well, who should be president? And she's like, I don't know, which is the nicest one? My, you know, my dad says whoever's a jerk. And so that's how Carter gets picked, apparently. Yeah. In this timeline.
Yeah, that was actually pretty funny. I remember that.
Yeah. I guess another thing I liked in the book was sort of the quasi-science that mm-hmm. was mentioned, where like they would talk about, oh, well, what is this? And she would, you know, like, what is the library? You know, isn't this just a big room? You know, why don't... And she's like, oh, well, it's a four-dimensional shadow of the 17-dimensional construct.
There's some sort of hamburger wrapper involved or something.
Well, right. So basically, she's trying to explain what the library is, because she goes up into the library, into this like upper part, and she's like, oh, there's the earth and here's the sun and everything. And he's like, oh, are these like representations? He's like, oh, no, that's the actual thing.
Right.
And he's like, he reaches out to touch it, and he's like, well, maybe I shouldn't touch it. and so she's like, well, you know, think of this, the library is like a hamburger wrapper. It's like a superset of the universe. It's a hamburger wrapper around the, you know, the hamburger of the universe thing that you're seeing now. So,
you know, I think I finally glommed onto who this really reminds me of. Q.
Kind yeah, of. Sure.
It's very Q-esque.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe that's why they called it Q-33 North. But yeah, you're right. It's. I guess he also kind of doesn't quite get it.
Yeah, I mean, there's that whole, you know, not to digress too far, but there's that whole episode of Next Generation where he basically becomes human for a while as punishment.
Well, one of my favorite episodes, right. Actually.
And he's like, and this thing happened, and I lost consciousness. Like, it's called falling asleep. He's like, oh.
Or he's like, I've got this pain in my stomach. I don't understand. Have you eaten yet? What's that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know who I would be. You know, it's like in any book, you know, there's always like this power fantasy of, well, of course I'd want to be the god, but I'm like, I don't think I would want to be Carolyn. And not just because of her childhood, just like she's still kind of not quite getting everything.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of ups and downs for like, especially if you want to choose one of the librarians, right? You mm-hmm. know, there's, you know, like, oh, it might be interesting to be Margaret, you know, the healer, but it's like she ends up getting, you know, killed like 50, 60 times and being brought back. And that doesn't seem that great. And, but you know, on the other hand, now she spends most of her days stoned out of her gourd and still like rather functional, which I appreciate.
Nobununga, the lion.
You know, I think I might.
He's one of Father's buddies, and he's one of the two people that go off to in the new universe with him. So
yeah,
the son and Nobununga. So
no, it's, I think it's, Naga, right? Naga, Naga goes off into
Naga stays.
Yeah.
Naga goes to visit her family at the end.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
She actually seems like
when Steve was dead,
come out like fairly right. Well ahead without having, you know, too much psychological damage.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd choose the lion.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty good choice. Kevin, would you go for Erwin, perhaps?
Erwin. I always thought Bear would be Erwin.
Well,
he doesn't give any crap, and he's like,
he does call the president a pussy.
And at the end, like, Carolyn comes up. She's like, I need you to find a dog for me because I promised Steve I would find his dog, but the dog might be dead.
No, it's actually a very specific dog. It's got to be Petey.
Yeah, Petey. Right?
Because that's Steve's dog that he had before going off and doing the breaking and entering and burgling job that Carolyn... Wow. It's like, it's just like full circle in this book.
There's no brief descriptions. I mean, you know, because everything is linked to everything else. And it's just like, and this was tied to this and this was tied to this.
Maybe it could be the Resat guy real.
I think you should be Q33 North.
Yes, that makes the most sense. I'm Q33 North. Well,
what is it? We're not exactly sure, but it's terrifying.
I mean, because that was another thing where they were talking about the Resat guy real and like, you know, as far as a magic system. And they're like, it's, you know, it needs a physical thing for it to work, right? And so it's like the marker is the book that Steve gives her when they're a kid right before this happens.
The, you know, copy of Black Beauty.
Black Beauty. And like, and then when they're explaining it, they're like, well, it's sort of this recursive construct that's like connected to the plane of despair.
Plane of despair.
Right.
It's not like the book you keep in your recording box, right? I mean, that is a link to the plane of despair as well.
Don't even think of trying to get out of that.
Right. And so at the, and then, you know, when she's explaining, you know, later on, it's like, oh, it's not going to affect you. It only affects people that were basically at the barbecue that ate the deer that I was friends with that, you know, David murdered right next to me while I was sleeping with them. So, hey, I didn't eat that and everyone else was there, they ate it, so they're screwed. And like, so it kind of like ties the whole thing together with, you know, I would kind of like to know the origin of even the term resac irea.
Yeah, it seems like it's some sort of easily decodable thing, but right. I haven't figured it out yet and never will. This has been a message from fatalism.
Well, maybe Scott Hawkins will tell us.
Yeah, Scott, if you're listening, let us know.
Okay, well then, if you would like to get in contact with us, there's Twitter, where you can find us at SF3Podcast. On iTunes, or rather what they call Apple Podcasts these days, if you search for sci-fi, 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 all one word, then you'll find us.
Or SF3.
SF3, which is a lot easier. And let's see, if you want to reach us by mail, I hope you mean email. and it's sf3podcast@gmail.com.
We do not have a P.O. box.
We do not yet have a P.O. box. Kevin, are we checking? Do we check that email?
Yes, we do.
Oh, good. Great.
We get a low volume email, so you can add to it if you like.
Because we're a very popular podcast.
Well, you know, it's special.
It's very special. We only allow certain people to listen to our podcast.
Exactly.
Those who know about it.
Only some people go through a formality of actually listening to the podcast.
You too can be an SF3 podcast librarian.
Yes. Well, I think we need to decide which of us we're going to freeze in a moment and turn into the sun for this new universe we're going to have to create now. I think it's going to be Barry, but...
I was looking at you, actually, yeah, Steve.
I figured.
Hey, you remember Father did create two new things, light and pleasure.
That's true.
He's not a bad guy, right?
So one of us becomes the sun, one of us becomes the light, and... yeah, I don't know.
You are the sun, I am the moon. That didn't really go very well. All right, well, until next time, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.